scheduled to speak at an event in Allentown, Pennsylvania. When the sponsors heard that I had been injured, they were worried, but I was determined to keep my commitment. My solution was to ask for a stool to sit on while I spoke. But when I did the event, I was struck by the connection that I was able to make with my audience. I realized it was because I was sitting. It was an amazing lesson. I never went back to standing, thanks to my bad back and my ability to connect with an audience at a high level that literally changed my life. As a leader, you need to see opportunities differently than most people. They are a chance for you to learn about yourself, your team, and your opportunities. They provide you a way to improve your own life, improve the lives of others, and gain influence. That's why I say that problem solving is the fastest way to gain leadership. I hope this gives you a new perspective and you begin to use challenges and problem solving as assets to your leadership. Developing the problem solver within you. Whether you want to receive an opportunity to lead or you already have leadership responsibilities and desires to make an impact, problem solving affords you unique opportunities as a leader. Grow in this area by answering these three questions. What does the way I handle problems say about me? How you see problems shapes your attitude and your leadership. Do you see problems as an opportunity to use your leadership for the betterment of your team and organization? Or are they inconveniences that simply ruin your plans and discourage you? You can change your mindset when it comes to problems and solving them. Make a list of past problems that have led to lessons or opportunities similar to the way I described my experiences at the end of this chapter. Then make the decision to look for the potential positives in your problems from this day forward. How can I enlist others as problem solvers? Starting this week, when you face problems, begin using questions to learn more about the members of your team. Gather information, brainstorm ideas, and find multiple solutions to problems. Here are a few questions to help you get started. When did the problem begin? Where did it begin? Who was the first to notice it? What are several possible causes for it? What is the impact of the problem? Who's affected? What other possible negative consequences could it have? Is this problem part of a bigger problem? If so, how? Who has dealt with this kind of problem successfully? What are several possible approaches to solving it? What kind of time, expertise, and resources will be needed for these solutions? Will people buy into these solutions? How many will each of these solutions take to implement? How long will each of these solutions take to implement? How might these solutions give us future advantages? What lessons can be learned from all of this? What future opportunities are presenting themselves in current problems? Pick one big problem you're constantly working on, and as you seek solutions, brainstorm as many creative opportunities as possible that could be associated with the problem and the solution. Allow these thoughts to shape the problem-solving process, because if you're able to use a problem to actually move your team or organization farther ahead, you have done one of the most difficult of all leadership tasks. Become a change agent. Chapter 6. The Extra Plus in Leadership. Attitude. Think of a friend, colleague, family member, or mentor whom you greatly admire. Now stop. Don't continue on with me for a moment. I want you to really think of a name and write it down. Now, at the conclusion of writing that down, I want you to write 5 things that you admire most about this person. I think you'll gain an interesting and important insight by doing it. So please, again, you know, just stop the tape and write down what you admire about that person. Now, why did I ask you to do this? Because I found that most of the time, many of the characteristics we admire in others have to do with attitude. We admire and like to be around people who are positive, tenacious, and expectant. People with a good attitude lift us up. They inspire us. When it comes to leadership, attitude becomes even more important. You need to see possibilities when others don't. You need to encourage people when they are feeling defeated and just demonstrate commitment when others want to quit. Author and pastor Charles Swindoll pointed out how the right attitude is central to this success. He said, "The longer I live, the more I realize the impact of attitude on life. Attitude to me is more important than facts. It's more important than the past, than education, than money, than circumstances, than failures, than successes, than what other people think or say or do. It's more important than appearance, giftedness, or skill. It will make or break a company, a church, or a home. The remarkable thing is that we have a choice every day regarding the attitude we will embrace for that day. We cannot change our past, nor can we change the fact that people will act in a certain way. We also cannot change the inevitable. The only thing that we can do is play on the one string that we have, and that is our attitude. I am convinced that life is 10% of what happens to me and 90% of how I react to it. And so it is with you. We are in charge of our attitudes." A good attitude is an extra plus in life. It makes our lives better. And it also makes our leadership better, because leadership has less to do with position than it does disposition. The attitude or disposition of leaders is important because it influences the thoughts and feelings of the people they lead. Good leaders understand that a positive attitude creates a positive atmosphere which encourages positive and productive responses from others. Whatever it takes, a leader's attitude. This chapter is going to put some muscle in your attitude. To be an effective leader, you don't have to be happy all the time or be a cheerleader, but you need to have a good attitude. If you ask me to identify the single most important aspect of a successful leader's attitude, it would be possessing a whatever-it-takes mindset, the invisible line that separates those who get things done from those who merely dream about them, is an attitude of total commitment. Great leaders are sold out to achieving success in the face of any problem and are willing to pull out all the stops to help the team win. This whatever it takes attitude is common in all great leaders and serves both the leader and the people well. A leader's attitude must exemplify resolve, tenacity, focus, determination, and commitment. It must demonstrate consistency, see possibilities, and fight for the victories during tough times. This kind of attitude isn't hard to understand, but it can be hard to live, so I want to give you some steps that you can take to develop it and embody it as a leader. Number one, disown your helplessness. Whatever it takes, leaders aggressively pursue solutions. You never hear them say, "There's nothing we can do about it." Those are the words of someone with a victim's mindset. Professor and expert on organizational behavior, Robert E. Quinn, wrote, "A victim is a person who suffers a loss because of the actions of others. A victim tends to believe that salvation comes only from the actions of others. They have little choice but to whine and wait until something good happens. Living with someone who chooses to play the victim role is draining. Working in an organization where many people have chosen that victim role is absolutely depressing. Like a disease, the condition tends to spread. Unfortunately, the victim disease has spread throughout America. More and more people have slipped from a can-do attitude to one of helplessness." In John F. Kennedy's inauguration speech, he charged the young people of America to ask not what their country could do for them, but what they could do for their country. Hundreds of thousands rose up and responded to that challenge, becoming part of the Peace Corps, which served people around the world. President Kennedy had a whatever-it-takes mindset, and his attitude as a leader spread to others. Today, more than 50 years later, the mindset in our country has changed from "we can make a difference" to "we can make no difference." Quiet determination has evolved into noisy demands. How did this happen? The leadership of our nation slowly began to empower government to meet the needs of the people. Responsibility shifted from each individual person to the government. Leaders stopped challenging the people to be the answer to their problems and began positioning themselves as the answer. Now people tend to wait and depend on others for solutions instead of being proactive and self-reliant. To be successful, leaders need to disown their helplessness and help the people on their teams do the same. They can do that by empowering others, and here's how. Never make excuses. Create a can-do environment where people are expected to solve their problems. Model a whatever-it-takes attitude to your team. Provide training that enables team members to succeed. Challenge people to take responsibility for their performance. Make everyone feel valued and important as part of the team. Give solid feedback after team members try to tackle a challenge. Celebrate with team members who are succeeding. Give people increasing challenges to test their growth and give them wins. In our current culture, it may seem like a tremendous challenge to inspire people to give up their helplessness and become more proactive. But all it takes is belief in our ability to make a difference. Years ago, I read a story from columnist Nell Mahoney about a double-blind experience conducted in the San Francisco Bay Area. The principal of a school called some teachers together and said, "Because you three teachers are the finest in the system, and you have the greatest expertise, we're going to give you 90 high IQ students, and we're going to let you move these students throughout the next year at their own pace and just see how much they can learn." The students and the teachers were delighted. Over the next year, the teachers and the students thoroughly enjoyed themselves. The teachers loved teaching the brightest students, and the students benefit from the close attention and instruction of the highly skilled teachers. By the end of the year, the students had achieved 20 to 30% more than other students in the area. At the end of the experiment, the principal called the teachers back together and said, "I have a confession to make. You did not have 90 of the most intelligent, prominent students. They were run-of-the-mill students. We took 90 students at random from the system and just gave them to you." The teacher said, "This means that we are exceptional teachers." "I have another confession," the principal admitted. "You're not the brightest of the teachers. Your names were the first three drawn out of a hat." Now, how could three average teachers accomplish so much with 90 average students? The teachers and the students possessed an exceptionally positive and proactive attitude. They didn't feel helpless. They didn't think of themselves as victims. They believed they could succeed, and they did. Number two, take the bull by the horns. President Theodore Roosevelt said, "There is nothing brilliant nor outstanding about my career except perhaps one thing. I do the things that I believe ought to be done, and when I make up my mind to do a thing, I act." That's a great description of whatever it takes leaders. They are fearless and don't hesitate to take the bull by the horns and wrestle it to the ground. They take action. Effective leaders who want milk don't sit on a stool in the middle of the field and hope for the cow to come and find them. Author Danny Cox said he interviewed a reform school graduate who had become a successful entrepreneur not once but twice. When he asked the man the key to his success, he said he had asked himself the following questions and really listened to his own answers. What do I really want? What will it cost? Am I willing to pay the price? And when should I start paying the price? Notice that the last question is designed to prompt action. If a leader doesn't answer the last question and make a commitment to a start date, the first three questions don't really matter. And, of course, the best answer to that last question is now. One of the best stories I've ever heard illustrating the difference between people who seize initiative and those who don't occurred on February 14, 1876. That was the day inventor Elisha Gray finally went to the patent office with his idea about a device that had the potential to transmit voice over wires. Gray had been experimenting with ideas for this device for some time. But even on that day in February, he wasn't applying for a patent, only a caveat, which was a document declaring that he intended to create the invention and try to patent it. But at the patent office, he learned that just a few short hours before, another inventor had been there and filed for a patent of a similar device. That person? Alexander Graham Bell. Gray tried to challenge Bell's claim in court, saying he, not Bell, had come up with the idea first. But the court sided with Bell. You don't want to find yourself in a similar position of Gray's. To be successful as a leader, you need to possess initiative. W. Clement Stone taught me this in 1976 when I heard him speak in Dayton, Ohio, on procrastination. He told everyone in the audience that for 30 days each morning before the getting out of bed, they should repeat out loud, "Do it now, do it now, do it now," 50 times. And at the end of each day, before going to sleep, they again should say 50 times out loud, "Do it now, do it now, do it now." W. Clement Stone said, if you'll do this every morning and every evening for 30 days, at the end of the month, you will automatically respond positively to any opportunity. I actually followed his advice. It changed my attitude and eliminated my tendency to procrastinate. I suggest that you try that exercise for 30 days, then go look for some bulls. Number 3, enter the no whining zone. Whatever it takes, people know how to handle their feelings. They put their attitude in charge of their emotions. We all experience times when we feel bad, and our attitude can't stop our feelings, but it can keep our feelings from stopping us. After all, what's the use of complaining if it doesn't get you anywhere? Nobody likes a whiner. Whiners wear people out. There's nothing attractive about someone who complains. That's true for leaders and their teams. When I meet a leader who allows his team members to whine and complain, I wonder why they would have someone like that on their payroll. They can get people to do that for free. What's the best solution to guard against becoming a complainer? Cultivate gratitude. It is by far the most effective antidote to a negative attitude and a complaining spirit. Here are 3 suggestions for how to do that. Express gratitude independent of your feelings. Sometimes my heart is so heavy it weighs me down and inhibits my desire to express gratitude verbally. But unexpressed gratitude is like no gratitude at all. So in such times I force my tongue to guide my heart and express gratitude anyway. Not because I feel like it, but because it's right. Often my words begin to lift my heart, and I feel gratitude that matches what I say. Express gratitude for the small and ordinary things. There's a story about an immigrant shopkeeper whose son came to see him one day and complained, "Dad, I don't understand how you run this store. You keep your accounts payable in a cigar box, your accounts receivable are on a spindle, and all your cash is in the register. You never know what your profits are." "Son," responded his father, "let me tell you something. When I arrived in this country, all I owned were the pants I was wearing. Now your sister is an art teacher, your brother is a doctor, and you're a CPA. Your mother and I own a house and a car and this little store. Add that all up and subtract the pants, and there's your profit. The more we complain, the less we'll obtain." Or as Michelangelo said, "If we learn to appreciate more of what we already have, we'll find ourselves having even more to appreciate. And if you can appreciate the small things, the big things will mean that much more." Express gratitude, especially in the midst of adversity. Few things test our attitude the way adversity does. I greatly admire people who are able to keep their spirits up when they face difficulties, and I try to emulate them. I read that in 2002, immediately after Charlton Heston revealed that he had Alzheimer's disease, that he was in high spirits flying from Los Angeles to Utah with his close friend, Tony Makris, the political consultant. Makris described their conversation this way. "He looked at me and said, 'Why so glum, pal? You feel bad for me? I said yes. Don't, replied his friend. I got to be Charlton Heston for almost 80 years. That's more than fair. When we are grateful, fear disappears, and faith appears, and that gives us strength and motivation to act. Good leaders are never complainers, they're doers. When things go wrong, they start working and rallying people to help them. Number 4, put on a new pair of shoes. The art of leadership is getting things done with and through other people. As a person develops the leader within, he spends less time on personally producing and more time working with others to help them produce. To be successful at that, you need to be able to see things from their point of view, or as the old saying goes, spend a day in their shoes. I think President Harry Truman was wise when he said, "When we understand the other fellow's viewpoint, understand what he is trying to do, 9 out of 10 times he is trying to do right." As a leader, I always try to see things from 2 perspectives, that of the person I'm working with and my own. I use the other person's perspective to make the connection. Then I use mine to give direction. But I am able to see things from another person's point of view only if I'm willing to be open to that person. Tim Hansel, teacher and founder of the Summit Expedition, described the importance of this in his book, Through the Wilderness of Loneliness. He wrote, "It is difficult to receive when your fists are clenched. It is impossible to embrace when your arms are crossed. It is difficult to see when your eyes are closed. It is hard to discover when your mind is made up. And a heart that has sealed itself off from giving has unknowingly sealed itself off from the ability to receive love." I love people, but I still have to make an intentional effort to connect with them. I've always made it a practice to meet and greet people before a speaking engagement, moving from one table to another, saying hello, or simply just being on the floor in front of the stage so that I can chat with the people. I call this walking slowly through the crowd. Leaders need to connect with people, not just for the sake of building relationships, which is important, but also for the sake of building their organizations. When I meet new people, I try to see their potential for a role in one of my organizations. I'm not only assessing their talent by asking myself, can they? I'm also asking myself, will they? Which relates to their perspective and their attitude. That's why I need to try to see things from their point of view. If they can and will, then there's a good chance we can work together. Number 5, nurture your passion. Leaders with great attitudes and whatever it takes mindsets usually exude energy and enthusiasm, and those things fuel them to strive for excellence. That's why I believe the best career advice any person can receive is find your passion and follow it. That's what I've done for 50 years. Because I'm passionate about what I do, I feel like I've never had to work a day in my life. I've simply done what I love to do. They say retirement is doing what you love to do any time you want to do it, and if that's true, then I'm retired. Adding value to people through writing, speaking, and investing time in my companies is exactly what I want to do. And since I get to do those things every day, I'm getting to do it when I want to. Author and pastor Ken Hemphill says vision does not ignite growth, passion does. Passion fuels vision. And vision is the focus of passion. Leaders who are passionate about their call create vision. I couldn't agree more. Number 6, exceed expectations. One of my favorite companies, the John Maxwell Team, trains and develops people to become coaches and speakers. So far, we've trained 16,000 coaches in well over 100 countries. Twice a year, the company hosts what we call International Maxwell Certification Event in Orlando. 4 intense days of training. One of the things I emphasize to the new coaches each time I speak is that I want them to exceed their clients' expectations, to always under-promise and over-deliver. I believe that 75% of the people fall short when it comes to delivering on expectation, and only about 5% of all people exceed them in the service they provide. But the people who comprise that 5% make the world go round. They also receive the benefits that come from possessing that attitude and delivering on their promise. Few things will develop you more as a leader than choosing to exceed expectations. This was a key step in my own personal development. I was only 22 when I accepted the responsibility of leading my first church. The people were delightful as long as I visited the sick, preached on Sundays, and counseled those who asked for it. I was meeting their expectations. But after a few months of doing these things, I began to feel restless. I wanted to do more. My vision for making a difference was larger than their expectations of me. I possessed a great passion to reach new people. I had big ideas. What was I going to do? After a couple of weeks of wrestling with this issue, I came to this decision. Wherever I am, whoever I am with, whatever I am doing, and whenever I have an opportunity, I will set the bar of expectations for myself higher than others do for me. That commitment has shaped my development as a leader for 50 years. It made me responsible for my own leadership growth, and by setting my own bar high, I had to grow to reach it. If you're wondering how to do that, consider these things. Giftedness. I set the bar for myself the highest in my areas of strength, because that is where I have the greatest potential to grow and become excellent. In areas of weakness, I ask for the help of others. Growth. As I grow in the areas of my strengths and achieve some level of success, I don't rest on that achievement. I try to build upon it. That means raising the bar for myself again. If I don't do that, I will plateau. Opportunities. I see any opportunity that uses my strengths as an opportunity to improve by practicing and applying what I've learned. That attitude helps me continue growing and improving. Others' expectations. I always ask to find out the expectations of the people who desire my services. I can't meet or exceed an expectation I'm unaware of. I have built my career by making the meeting of their expectations my minimum. My own expectations. Since I use the expectations of others as the ground floor for my own expectations, I'm able to build upon them. I put effort into discerning what more I can give that will please them and add the most value. My desire is to always blow them away. The attitude of exceeding expectations will deliver a high return to you as a leader. As I tell my people, if you deliver on what you promise and meet expectations, you will get paid. If you exceed expectations, you'll get another contract. Everything you give above expectations is everything. Number 7, never be satisfied. The final attitude characteristic of whatever it takes leaders is to have positive discontent. Good leaders are never satisfied with what is. They see what could be, and they continually seek to achieve it. This is what drives them to get better, to achieve more, and to lead their people into new territory. The future belongs to people who are dedicated to making their world, their teams, and themselves better. Putting a whatever-it-takes attitude into action. Someone I know who is never satisfied with past accomplishments is Paul Martinelli, the president of the John Maxwell team. I have known few people dedicated to a relentless pursuit of improvement like his. Under his leadership, the company has experienced explosive growth, yet he is still working hard to do more, to be more. Recently, when I congratulated him for a very successful year, he smiled and said, "John, we aren't even close to reaching our potential. We are still learning our way through failure." As a leader, Paul has a whatever-it-takes attitude, and that's why he is so successful. I want to acquaint you with the way Paul puts his whatever-it-takes attitude into action. I believe it will help you develop the leader within you in this area of your life. Number 1, test. While others are crippled by worry, fear, or anxiety, Paul is taking action. He never waits for the perfect moment to act. It's the job, that it's never started that takes the longest to finish. Paul tests his ideas by implementing them and seeing how far away he is from the ideal outcome. T. Boone Pickens reminded leaders of how important it is to take positive steps forward to put things into motion. He said, "Sometimes the window of opportunity is opened only briefly. Waiting is not a decision, although many people think it is. Be willing to make a decision. Be willing to make decisions. That's the most important quality in a good leader. Don't fall victim to what I call the ready, aim syndrome. You must be willing to fire. To help you be willing to test your ideas into action, I have three suggestions. I encourage you to take to heart and put these into practice. Challenge every assumption. Good leaders always challenge assumptions. They don't take assumptions for granted because they understand that their first responsibility as a leader is to define reality. They need to be able to see below the surface, know what's really going on, and to be able to communicate that reality to their people. The most important time to challenge assumptions is when you're successful. If your organization's growth rate is high, you may assume that your systems and processes are good. Maybe they're not. Maybe you're leaving a lot of money or opportunity on the table by doing the things the way you have been doing them. The only good assumption in your business is that there's a better way to do your business. Always ask questions. How will you know whether your test is successful? How will you go about finding better ways of doing things? The answer is to ask hard questions. You can't allow any fear of hearing negative answers to keep you from asking questions. Hard truths responded to correctly help you become better. Ask the following questions. Is there a better way to do what we do? What can we learn from others who do what we do? Who can help us do better in what we do? Are the current numbers the best that we can do? Am I growing each year doing what I do? How can I become better to help my team become better? Paul calls questions like these the door to willingness, to try new things, to take more risk, change what isn't working, and stretch to be better than we were in the past. I love that. Benchmark against your potential, not your past. Too often leaders determine a good year based on last year. But great accomplishments never come from using yesterday as a benchmark. That's an attitude of protecting against losses more than making gains. To make great progress, leaders must benchmark against the future potential of their team or organization and the opportunities before them. Testing is a way to challenge the status quo and reach for that potential. Number two, fail. Testing can be challenging and a frightening experience. Why? Because it can lead to failure. However, failure is an essential step in the cycle of success. Paul said, "The willingness to fail is essential for a leader to model and the team to embrace. If we allow the fear of failure to control our attitude and actions, we'll never become the leaders we have the potential to be. And we'll never take any of our teams or organizations where they have the potential to go, accomplishing all that they could accomplish." Paul worked at coaching people to reach their potential for more than a decade. As a young entrepreneur, he wanted to teach other business leaders what he had learned through trial and error. He's aware that some people have a hard time taking risk. Paul said most people, leaders included, try everything in their power to avoid failure, and they should, but they should not avoid making the big bets, taking the big risk, or initiating the new efforts that put them and their team in a position to fail so that they can seek the rewards of growth. I think what has led us to some of our greatest achievements has not been my or my team's willingness to do our best. We should always be doing our best. Rather, it has been our willingness to do our all, to test every possible opportunity, to test every new innovation, to test every person's ability and potential. To be successful, you need to be willing to fail. You need to maintain a positive attitude and a strong belief in yourself, even when you fall flat. What does that mean? How can you maintain the right attitude? See failure as a constant companion of success. Progress always means entering uncharted territory. It means putting yourself out there to be scrutinized and criticized. It means exposing yourself to new pressures and demands. It's only human to wonder if you're up to the challenge. A small, anxious part of you would probably rather not take that risk. That part is what keeps many would-be leaders from taking action and becoming productive and effective. The price of success is failure. As someone said, rockets blowing up on launch pad is why we have footprints on the moon, and blown circuits are why the world is illuminated with electricity. If we want success, we need to embrace failure. Highly creative choreographer Twyla Tharp has pushed the boundaries of her craft for decades. In an interview reported in the Harvard Business Review, she said, "Sooner or later, all real change involves failure, but not in the sense that many people understand failure. If you do only what you know and do it very, very well, chances are that you won't fail. You just stagnate, and your work will get less and less interesting, and that's failure by erosion. True failure is a mark of accomplishment, in the sense that something new and different was tried. The only people who have not failed are those who have not tried. We need to remember that trial and error by definition includes error. We have to get used to it. See success as colorfully varied, not monochromatic. What would life be like if everything you tried was successful? I think it would be boring, predictable, and bland. The struggles we experience make the successes we achieve worthwhile. Without the pain, how would we be able to appreciate our progress? We need to welcome the unexpected and to be open to a picture of success different from the expected. Recently, I was reading an article about music written by Allison Eck, who works for the PBS documentary series Nova. In it, she wrote about some differences between classical and jazz musicians and how they approach music. I found it especially interesting as she discussed musical notes called accidentals. Eck wrote, "In music, accidentals are musical pitches, rather musical glitches, that don't belong to the scale or mode currently in use. A more sensible name for those rogue notes would be purposefuls, since they are always written into a piece for a precise reason. In classical jazz and any other genre, accidentals subvert the listener's expectations on purpose. The coolest thing about accidentals is that they bust out of musical boundaries in the most unapologetic way. Musicians emphasize these notes. They dramatize their presence as if to say, 'Yes, you heard me correctly.' Accidentals show us just how trite it is to bicker over categories or labels, no matter what kind of working you're doing. The accident on purpose is a near universal phenomenon. A productive life is a colorful life, not a monochromatic gray, and a person's progress can take on many different forms. Failure to achieve what you intended can often lead to an entirely different kind of success. Maybe even a better version of success than you ever imagined. Failure is fun when it's overcome. Failure adds color when it gives you notes you would not necessarily hear. Success is a story filled with good things, accidental things, hard things, new things, learned things. So take X advice. Be an accidental. Deviate from what's expected, but understand the context in which you're doing so. What's the reason for your accident? How does it relate to everything else in your story, art, or design? Make your mistakes out loud and on purpose. In other words, be willing to fail. Have a game plan to get over failure. Why do so many people get bogged down by failure? Sarah Rapp, a social impact startup consultant, said, When it comes to failing, our egos are our own worst enemies. As soon as things start going wrong, our defense mechanisms kick in, tempting us to do what we can to save face. In an article Rapp wrote about interviewing economist Tom Harford, author of Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure, she said that failure causes a variety of reactions. The first is denial. It seems to be the hardest thing in the world to admit we've made a mistake and try to put it right. It requires you to challenge a status quo of your own making, she said. Another is chasing our losses. We're so anxious not to draw a line under a decision we regret that we end up causing still more damage while trying to erase it. For example, poker players who've just lost some money are primed to make bigger risk bets than they normally make in a hasty attempt to win the lost money back and erase the mistake. Rapp suggests trying to become dispassionate about our failures and working not to get too attached to our plans. The danger is a plan that seduces us into thinking failure is impossible and adaptation is unnecessary. Rapp wrote, a kind of Titanic plan, unsinkable until it hits an iceberg. I have my own game plan for dealing with failure. It's the same as the one I have for success, the 24-hour rule. I give myself just 24 hours to celebrate a success or to cry over a failure. After that, I move on. As a leader, I can't let yesterday control today. Yesterday ended last night. I need to look forward and prepare for today. Number 3, learn. A friend once gave me the formula for becoming an overnight success. He said, you show up every day, you work hard, you try new things, you fail, you improve, you grow, you face countless challenges and rejections, you doubt yourself, you want to quit, but you don't, and you do it all over again and again and again and again. Do this for months, years, and even decades, and you can become an overnight success. One of the most important beliefs of having the right attitude as a leader comes after testing and failing. That's when we have the greatest opportunity to learn. As leadership trainer Roland Nynego commented, a mistake is only a failure if you don't learn from it. Not all leaders embrace this truth. In my experience, people do one of three things when they fail. They resolve not to make a mistake again. Now that's foolish. They allow their mistake to make cowards out of them. That's fatal. They develop the security to learn from their mistakes, and that's fruitful. The exciting thing is that the learning, if the leader is open to it, truly does form them and their team in every meaningful way. We form new thinking patterns. We form new communication styles. We form new relationships. We form new habits. We form new beliefs. We form new mental models. We do, in fact, become inwardly formed in new ways, and those new forms become the new and stronger foundations that we can build on and live from. You see, the test, fail, learn process creates new content for our lives and our teams, and the content of our lives is always the curriculum of our evolution. We learn both what does work and what does not work. Both are necessary and equally valuable to the leader. We learn how to motivate and push our team and how to not motivate and push our teams. I have yet to meet a highly successful leader who wasn't a learner. And the best part is that it doesn't take talent to learn. It doesn't take experience. It just takes the right attitude. If we see failure as normal and experience learning from it as positive, we can take risk. We can strike out into uncharted territory. We can face loss. We can have the potential to achieve almost anything as leaders. And we can help other people to achieve beyond their wildest expectations for themselves. Number 4, improve. What is the greatest value of learning? I believe it comes when we improve. That's where the rubber meets the road. Otherwise, what we learn is only academic. Social psychologist Heidi Grant Halverson, characterizes the difference between those who desire to improve and those who desire to prove to others that they've got it. Success often asks the question, what am I getting? Improvement always asks, what am I becoming? Improvement through growth is the only guarantee that tomorrow will be better. The profile of someone who improves looks differently from that of other people. Everybody makes mistakes, but not everybody corrects them. Everybody hears, but not everybody listens. Everybody has problems, but not everybody solves them. Everybody falls, but not everybody gets back up. Everybody receives lessons from life, but not everybody improves from them. Everybody needs to make changes, but not everybody does. Social psychologist Heidi Grant Halverson says people approach any task with one of two mindsets. What I call the be good mindset, where your focus is on proving that you have a lot of ability and already know what you're doing, and the get better mindset, where your focus is on developing ability. You can think of it as the difference between wanting to prove that you are smart and wanting to get smarter. The problem with the be good mindset is that it tends to cause problems when you're faced with something unfamiliar or difficult. We start worrying about making mistakes because mistakes mean that we lack ability, and this creates a lot of anxiety and frustration. The get better mindset, on the other hand, is practically bulletproof. When we think about what we are doing in terms of learning and mastering, accepting that we make some mistakes along the way, we stay motivated despite the setbacks that might occur. Kuzis and Posner in the Leadership Challenge wrote, "Leaders must challenge the process precisely because any system will unconsciously conspire to maintain the status quo and prevent change." If you're leading a group of people, then it's your responsibility to bring an attitude of improvement to the team and to help others embrace it. When individuals experience improvement and it adds value to them in ways that they value most, it changes their perspective on what's possible and expands their potential. I want to say one more thing about improvement here. I believe achieving any measure of success can impair our ability to imagine achieving something better. I used to get so excited about being part of any successful event that I would say, it doesn't get any better than this. But the truth is that even when we're highly successful, we need to keep looking for ways to improve. I think of this as the horizon of success effect. Here's what I mean by that. When we succeed, it becomes hard to see the potential that lies beyond the horizon of success. But we can't let that stop us from continuing to strive forward to improve. We need to keep ourselves from becoming satisfied. The old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, can cripple us when it comes to improving ourselves and those around us. An example of the need to overcome the horizon of success can be seen in my work on revising this book. Why would I revise a book that has sold more than 2 million copies? In the nonfiction publishing world, that's a grand slam. Because I know I could do it better. I could make it better. That attitude of striving to get to the next level is invaluable for a leader. Number 5, re-enter. Once you've tested a new way of doing something, failed, learned, and applied what you've learned, you're ready to re-enter the race with your whatever-it-takes attitude, strengthened with the new ways to approach challenges and to lead others. I found that when I've gone through this process, my commitment has increased, and that has made me a better leader. In the mid-1970s, while I was leading my second congregation in Lancaster, Ohio, I faced some challenges that tempted me to quit. But I knew that wasn't the right thing for me to do. I wanted to persevere. So every time I tried something new and failed, I tried to learn from it and apply it to my life so that I could improve. But that didn't keep me from becoming discouraged. To fight that, I wrote something to keep myself going. I was inspired by Scottish mountaineer W.H. Murray, and I kept those words with me on a laminated card, and here's what the card said. Commitment is the key. Until I'm committed, there is a hesitancy, a chance to draw back. But the moment I definitely commit myself, then God moves also, and a whole stream of events begin to erupt. All manner of unforeseen incidents, meetings, persons, and material assistance that I could have never dreamed would come my way begin to flow toward me the moment I make a commitment. Later, when I was leading my third church in San Diego, I had cards with the same message printed and laminated so I could give them out to my staff. I wanted them to be inspired to renew their resolve and keep leading at times when they felt discouraged. I hope this chapter on attitude has inspired you to dedicate yourself to developing a whatever-it-takes attitude so that you can experience the extra plus in leadership. That plus will give you an edge, not only in your own thinking, but also in your own ability to attract, lead, and inspire others. If you're like me, you benefit from reading positive words to maintain a positive attitude. I'm always on the lookout for books and quotes that inspire me to keep my head up and encourage the members of my team. Recently, I discovered something from Mark Batterson, author of a book called Chase the Lion. In it, he offers what he calls the Lion Chaser's Manifesto. Mark, like me, is a person of faith, so I hope you won't be offended by his perspective. But even if you skip over his remarks related to God and faith, I believe you will find his words inspiring. Lion Chaser's Manifesto. Quit living as if the purpose of life is to arrive safely at death. Run to the roar. Set God-sized goals. Pursue God-given passions. Go after a dream that is destined to fail without divine intervention. Stop pointing out problems. Become part of the solution. Stop repeating the past. Start creating the future. Face your fears. Fight for your dreams. Grab opportunity by the mane and don't let it go. Live like today is the first day and the last day of your life. Burn sinful bridges. Blaze new trails. Live for the applause of nail-scarred hands. Don't let what's wrong with you keep you from worshiping what's right with God. Dare to fail. Dare to be different. Quit holding out. Quit holding back. Quit running away. Chase the lion. Whatever the lion is in your life, I encourage you to adopt a whatever-it-takes attitude and to chase the lion for all that you're worth. Even if you never catch it, you'll never regret it. Developing the positive believer within you. I've observed that people are born with a natural bent when it comes to attitude. My father said very positive things to my siblings and I when we were growing up, and he was a constant encourager. But he admitted to me that he was not born that way. He had to work to become a positive believer in his own ability and that of others. Born winner or loser. What is your natural bent? Were you born thinking that you were a winner or a loser, victor or a victim? If you're already positive, great, keep it up. But if you were born seeing the glass half empty, you need to improve your attitude if you want to develop the leader within you. Start the process by keeping a gratitude journal. Every morning, write a list of things that you're grateful for. Don't start your day until you've written down at least one thing. And before you go to sleep at night, add to the morning list all the things you were grateful from that day that you've just spent. Day after day, keep adding to your gratitude list. After you've done this each day for a solid month, ask someone who knows you well whether they've seen any change in your attitude. Fail on purpose. Take a professional risk this month that you think is likely to fail so that you can use the process outlined in the chapter to improve your attitude. Start by deciding what the test will be. Write out that first step here. Test, fail, learn, improve, re-enter. Once you've written what the test will be, go do it. If you fail, then write about it under number 2, and then move on to what you learned, how you can improve, and what you must do to re-engage as a leader. If you don't fail, then still complete steps 3 through 5. But then try another test. you won't really benefit from this process until you failed and had to work through it. Chapter 7, The Heart of Leadership, Serving People. I spent a total of 26 years leading churches as a senior pastor. But when I was a young leader, just getting started in my career, my focus wasn't initially on serving people. It was on doing big things and getting ahead. All my training and education assumed a hierarchical approach to leadership. Pastors were educated, ordained, and positioned to sit apart from and above their congregations. We were expected to preach messages, give wise counsel, and conduct the ordinances of the church. The models of leadership were all top-down. But then I went to hear Zig Ziglar speak, and I heard him say, "If you help people get what they want, they will help you get what you want." What he was really talking about was servant leadership, and that idea rocked my world. Change of heart. Zig's comment made me realize something. I was trying to get others to help me, not trying to help them. I realized my attitude toward people wasn't right. And that knowledge started me on a journey that eventually made me realize that the heart of leadership is based on serving others, not myself. It challenged me to invent the power pyramid, putting others at the top and myself at the bottom. I started to change my leadership focus to empowering others to do what I was doing. And the real clincher came when I read a passage in the Bible as if it were for the very first time. It said, "So Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, the teachers, to equip his people for the works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up." This made it clear that my responsibility as a pastor was to equip God's people to do his work and build up the church. From that moment, I realized I wasn't supposed to get the people to help me build my congregation. I was to serve the people and help them build God's church. From that day on, my leadership has always been about serving others and not about being served by others. That was 45 years ago. My thinking about leadership and my approach to it has continued to be shaped by other people in this area. Robert Greenleaf has been an influence. In 1970, he wrote an essay called "The Servant as Leader," which he later expanded into the book Servant Leadership. Greenleaf wrote, "The servant leader is servant first. It begins with the natural feeling that one wants to serve first. Then conscious choice brings one to aspire to lead. The care taken by the servant first leader is to make sure that other people's highest priority needs are being served. The best test, and difficult to administer, is, do those served grow as persons? Do they, while being served, become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, more likely themselves to become servants? And what is the effect on the least privileged in society? Will they benefit or at least not be further deprived?" Other books, such as Leadership is an Art by Max Dupree, the former chairman of Herman Miller, and The Soul of the Firm by C. William Pollard, chairman emeritus of ServiceMaster, also assisted me on my journey to becoming a servant leader. But the book that made the greatest impression on me was Eugene Habecker's The Other Side of Leadership. It convinced me that adding value to others needed to be at the core of my leadership. I've had the privilege of knowing Eugene for more than 30 years. The words in his book are a description of his life. He said the true leader serves people, serves their best interest, and in so doing will not always be popular, may not impress. But because true leaders are motivated by loving concern rather than a desire for personal glory, they're willing to pay the price. Inspired by Eugene's life and his book, I made two decisions. First, I would place the concerns of others above my own, and second, I would love people unconditionally. The first was a matter of the will. The second was a change in attitude. And because I'm a person of faith, I adopted the following words from the Bible and took them to heart as the desire of my life. Tell those rich in this world's wealth
to quit being so full of themselves and so obsessed with money, which is here today and gone tomorrow. Tell them to go after God,